And without further ado, it's time for Oh the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship and research and events on campus at UNC. Always a lot going on, even on into the summer. And we are joined now by Lloyd Kramer, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities. How are you, Lloyd?
I'm great, Aaron. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. So without any ado before jumping into it, let's jump into it. We're talking about Elizabeth Keckley today. Because it is the bicentennial of her birthday in 1818, one of the most significant kind of historical figures in Orange County. Lloyd joining us here in the studio. We also have a special guest, Sylvia Hoffert, former UNC history professor, joining us here in the studio as well, who is an expert on Elizabeth Keckley. Sylvia, thanks for being here in the studio as well.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about Elizabeth Keckley for people who don't know.
Well, she was born in Virginia in 1818. She was born a slave. And she was brought to Orange County in 1835. She was on loan from her owner one of her owner's sons, Robert Burwell, who was a Presbyterian minister. He had a very large household. He came with three children, but eventually he and his wife would have 12 children. And she was their only servant, so she, had a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And her time here in Orange County was not particularly pleasant. They were fairly brutal to her. She apparently didn't get along with Mrs. Burwell, and so Mrs. Burwell, who didn't want to beat her, ordered her beaten, and that happened more than once. And she was also pursued by a neighbor in the Kirkland family, and he... raped her, and she had a child. And when just after the child was born, she was sent back to Virginia to the Burwell family. And then she was taken by another. She was loaned again to one of the Burwells, and that Burwell family, took her to St. Louis. And it was in St. Louis that she earned her freedom. St. Louis was, of course, very interesting geographically, because it's right across the river, the Mississippi River, from Illinois, which mm-hmm. is a free state. So the lure of freedom was with her when she was in St. Louis all the time. And she finally asked her master at the time if she could buy her freedom, and he said, no, I don't want to sell you. By that time, she was sewing. She's a fabulous seamstress, and she was sewing all the dresses for the family, but she was also sewing fancy dresses for the elite women of St. Louis, and her income was used to support the family. So she says, I supported 17 people, which is the entire family and all the slaves, for over 2 years. But she persisted. She was a nagger. So she persisted. And finally he said, okay, I will sell you and your son. I will sell you and your son to you for $1,200. Now, $1,200 in that period was about $33,000. Mm. So he's saying to his slave, if you can come up with $33,000, I'll save you. I'll sell you to yourself. So that was very difficult. As I said, she was working in the household. She was trying to earn money as a seamstress, and she wasn't making that kind of money. Mm-hmm. And so, she was pretty. She was unable to save that kind of money, and she was very disappointed. And one of her very rich customers talked to her one day about it and said, well, why don't you just borrow the money from your customers? Now, keep in mind, these were all white, very rich St. Louisans. And so they loaned her the money to buy her freedom.
Wow.
So she purchased her freedom in 1855, and then spent the next 5 years paying them off, basically.
Oh, my God.
In 1860, she sent her son, who is now well into his teens, off to Wilberforce University in Ohio, Xenia, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And she left St. Louis and went to Washington, D.C. And she says in her autobiography that her aspiration was to be the dressmaker for the First Lady. Mm-hmm. So she's an incredible networker, we would say today.
Is that the specific reason she went to Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's not clear. She said, that's what I wanted to do. So, the market was there, clearly. And so she became the seamstress for people like Verena Davis, which is Jefferson Davis's wife, and through her met all the other rich society and political matrons of Washington, D.C., eventually met Mary Todd Lincoln and became her dressmaker.
Wow. So that's an incredible story.
So, she was great resourcefulness.
Yeah. I just wanted to jump in here because, like many people in Orange County, I did not know the story of Elizabeth Keckley until Sylvia told me. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, is a perfect example of how we live in a community with all kinds of historical figures, mm-hmm. including enslaved people who went on to live lives of freedom, and how that story gets forgotten, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, had you read the story of Elizabeth Keckley?
I had not. And moving here to the Chapel Hill, Orange County area, you hear the story because Elizabeth Keckley is kind of a figure of local significance. I had never heard that name until I came to North Carolina. And until 2 minutes ago, I had only heard the rough details. She was a slave. She lived in Hillsborough. She won her freedom. She became Mary Todd Lincoln's dressmaker. And that was it. That's the extent of what I knew about Elizabeth Keckley. So that's a fascinating story. And you mentioned that it gets forgotten, in some cases deliberately so, right? Like, there's this whole history of stories like this being very consciously and actively swept under the rug.
So one of the things I just want to mention about how we connected with Sylvia on this is that we wanted teachers through the humanities program to have a better sense of how to teach the history of antebellum North Carolina with local figures, local historical figures. And Sylvia is, I would say, one of the great experts now on Elizabeth Keckley. But anyway, we interrupted your story. So what happens to her after?
Yeah, what happens next? Yeah.
I mean, we're so excited about the local connection.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, what happens is that she basically is Mary Lincoln's confidant. She becomes confidant of Mary Lincoln, partly because making dresses requires you spending a lot of time together, and it's pretty boring to be fitted for a dress. So Mary Todd Lincoln began to confide in her, and she became her confidant. And Mary Lincoln said that she was her confidant. But when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, Mary Lincoln, of course, left Washington, D.C., and she was in deep, deep mourning, and the one person she wanted with her was Elizabeth Keckley. Mm. So she took Elizabeth back to Illinois with her, and Elizabeth helped her get settled in Chicago. And then she came back to Washington, D.C., and of course she'd left her business. She had this thriving dressmaking business.
Yeah.
So she'd left her business and her workshop and all her employees to go with Mary Lincoln. And she came back, and you know, she assumed, I think, that Mary Lincoln was going to pay her for this time, only Mary Lincoln didn't. Mary Lincoln, if you know anything about her, was very... did not handle money well. Mm-hmm. She was a spendthrift and was deeply in debt, and so she didn't pay Elizabeth. So Elizabeth actually billed the United States government for the time and expenses that were incurred when she was in Chicago, and they paid her.
Good.
So she comes back, and she...
As well she should.
Yeah, exactly. And she continues her business... until about 1867, when Mary Lincoln, still in financial straits, decides that she needs to sell all of her old clothes. And so she's going to take all of her old clothes, her trunk loads of old clothes, to New York City, and she's going to try to sell them, and she wants Elizabeth to help her. Now, A, Elizabeth was her confidant. B, Elizabeth had made all the clothes. And C, clearly she was a good businesswoman, and Mary Lincoln was not.
Right.
So she actually asks Keckley to close her business and move to New York and help her sell her clothes. This was a financial disaster. No one wanted Mary Lincoln's clothes. And so Mary Lincoln, she feels entitled to whatever services people can provide her as a former First Lady. Mm-hmm. She goes back to Chicago and leaves Elizabeth to clean up the mess, basically, to finalize all of the arrangements to take care of the expenses involved. And Elizabeth had no source of income because, if you remember, she's closed her business.
Right.
So Elizabeth does do what she asks. She stays in New York, and she eventually... The reason we know about her is because she writes a autobiography that includes her time as a slave and her time with Mary Lincoln. And it's called Behind the Scenes. It's very readable. And she publishes it in 1867. And apparently, I mean, and it's the first, it's not the first White House
like
book
expose,
about being in the White House,
yeah.
But it is the first tell-all.
Okay.
And Mary Lincoln was so offended that this woman, she called her best living friend, never spoke to her again. So that completely ended the relationship.
Oh, wow.
The book did not do well.
I was going to ask how well. We know about it today.
We know about it. It has been republished, so it's easily accessible. But it didn't sell well, and it got very mixed reviews, but mostly bad reviews. You know, that people were appalled that a servant, and of course, Elizabeth Keckley was not a servant. She was not employed by the White House. She was a entrepreneur, businesswoman, but they saw her as a servant. So the white book reviewers said, you know, it's appalling that a servant would write secret things about their master and mistresses. And so she came back to Washington, and now she has no business. Her book's not making any money, and she has to, you know, support herself. She doesn't die until 1907. So she lives a long time after this book was published.
Wow.
And she became a member of the elite, African-American elite in Washington, D.C. She belonged to the 15th Street Baptist Church, which was the most elite black church in Washington, D.C. In the 1890s, she accepted a position teaching dressmaking at Wilberforce University.
Okay.
And leaves Washington. It looks like, it seems like she had a slight stroke, and so she had to come back in 1897, and she lives there, you know, until 1907.
Did she ever start her business back up again? Or?
She, it's not clear. It's clear that she was making a modest living, but it seems clear that she was not at the, you know, she was not making dresses for the white elite.
Right.
It is quite possible that by that time there was a black elite, which of course was invisible to the white elite of Washington, D.C., and she belonged to their church, and they knew who she was. And in fact, one of her fellow parishioners said, "Well, when we went to church, we looked to see what Elizabeth Keckley was wearing," which suggests that she was probably making dresses for rich black women who could afford, you know, the fancy dresses that she was used to making.
You mentioned her son went to Wilberforce. Do we know what happened
to him? We do, unfortunately.
Yeah,
he went to Wilberforce, and when the Civil War started, he passed as white, went back to St. Louis, signed up for the Union Army, and was killed almost immediately at the Battle of Wilson Creek, which is in Springfield, Missouri. So he was killed in one of the first battles of the Civil War.
It's a really, really fascinating story, and it underscores, and Lloyd, you were saying about this earlier today before we started, just the complexity of the interaction between people in America, and kind of talking about Orange County specifically, but in America in general, in the days and the years before the Civil War, too.
So one thing I wanted to mention is the particular link to Hillsborough because of the Burwell School, where you can still visit, and many people go by there from time to time. And you can see where Elizabeth lived and worked and how difficult it must have been for her there, and the amount of work she had to do. Because this family, as Sylvia said, I think they had 12, you said they had
12 children, but there was a boarding school.
Yeah.
So they had as many as 20 boarders in this school. So you add mom and dad and 12 children and 20 boarders, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. This is also a good point about names as well, because we talk about Elizabeth Keckley now as one of the most significant kind of historical figures in Orange County. The Burwell School is not named after Elizabeth Keckley. It's named after the slave-owning family that owned the school owned Elizabeth Keckley as well. And that's kind of ubiquitous across not just this community, but a huge swath of the country.
So one of the reasons we had this program, and Sylvia just spoke a couple of weeks on, 3 weeks ago on this, we want people who study the humanities or learn about the humanities to know that we're not only trying to deal with problems in the broader world, but with problems and traditions right here in Orange County, that our history is complicated. The relation between women and enslaved people and all of this is part of what we lose sight of. And Sylvia is contributing to the rediscovery of this process.
Yeah.
She's also writing amazing works on the Smith family, for whom Smith Level Road is named, and the Smith family who owned the largest plantation outside of Chapel Hill.
Tell us about them.
They're also from Hillsboro. Hillsboro was the sort of center of all this. Mary Ruffin Smith, there were three children, Mary Ruffin Smith and her two brothers, Frank and Sid. Frank was a doctor and Sid was a lawyer. Her father was a doctor who went bankrupt, so they started out in Hillsboro. But when he went bankrupt, he had to sell all of his Hillsboro property, and his wife had inherited what was called Price's Creek, and as well as some other property. But her father was smart enough to establish what was called a separate estate, which is to say that he kept the property out of the hands of Delia Smith's husband, James Smith. So when he went bankrupt, he had to sell all of his property in Hillsboro, but her property in Chapel Hill was safe because it was her property. So they moved to Price's Creek. The house is still off Smith Level Road. And the family is buried further south into just over Chatham County. By the time Mary Smith dies in the 1880s, she owns 3,000 acres. So it's most of the land south of Chapel Hill and then most of the land in northern Chatham County. Mm. And Galway Ridge is where they are actually buried. So if you go to Galway Ridge, there's a little cemetery off their back drive. And it's typical of North Carolina family cemeteries with a little wall, and they're all buried in there. So, and Mary Smith left all of her money to the they were big Episcopalians, so Episcopalian Church and to UNC, and they got all the property when she died. She was childless. She never married.
Speaking she lived after the Civil War, right?
After right. Oh, yeah, in the 1880s.
So the enslaved people had been emancipated.
Right.
But, yeah. So this all confirms the famous line by Faulkner that the past is not what? Past? It's not, no. It's never over. It's not even past.
It's not even past, yeah.
Everything Zilia's talking about is how the past is still with us right here in Orange County.
So speaking with Lloyd Kramer, Sylvia Hofford, humanities.unc.edu is the website for Carolina Public Humanities. We've got to wrap up because we're getting on to the end of the hour, but Lloyd, I'll let you have the last word because we've got the new fall schedule for Carolina Public Humanities,
too. Yeah, I want to encourage people to look
too.
At the new schedule. We'll be talking more about this in coming weeks, but Carolina Public Humanities is launching a very ambitious fall program of seminars, reading groups, and workshops, and we hope people will come out and join us.
Sounds good. Again, humanities.unc.edu is the website. Lloyd, Sylvia, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.